Homeless Link is the national membership charity for frontline homelessness services. We work to improve services through research, guidance and learning, and campaign for policy change that will ensure everyone has a place to call home and the support they need to keep it.
In this series of the Going Beyond podcast, we will discuss good practice in how to support individuals experiencing homelessness who have complex health and care needs. The episodes will cover dual diagnosis, physical health needs, hoarding, self-neglect, and brain injury. In each episode, we will speak to a guest who will tell us about their roles and expertise and provide practical tips for frontline staff to deliver good practice. I'm Jo Turner, National Practice Development Project Manager at Homeless Link, and I'll be your host. We hope you enjoy it. In this episode, we speak to Taylor, Specialist Health Lead for Single Homeless Project, along with Oscar and Jan from Groundswell, who are currently subcontracted into the NHS as Inclusion Healthcare Coordinators. We talk about the barriers people experiencing homelessness face in accessing physical healthcare and think about how frontline workers can approach conversations about health. Welcome, Taylor, Jan and Oscar. Thank you so much for being here today for the Going Beyond podcast in person too, which is very lovely. So to start us off, it would be great if you could all introduce yourself, give us a bit of an outline of the work that you do. So Taylor, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, so hi, I'm Taylor. I am a specialist health lead for Single Homeless Project. I'm one of four specialist health leads across our SHP services. And my role's kind of around three different parts. The first part is one-to-one working with clients. So I manage a caseload of clients who have different healthcare needs, and I support them to access healthcare, navigate their health, support appointments, help understand their healthcare options. The second part is around partnerships. So that includes forming partnerships with different NHS trusts and healthcare services to just make healthcare a bit more inclusive. We also run a few in-reach services just to make healthcare, like I said, more accessible for our clients. And then the third part is around advocacy and informing. So it's all about our recording and how we, help the discussions and make healthcare more accessible.
Amazing. Thank you. Oscar, I'll go to you now.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me today. I appreciate it. As you said, I'm Oscar, and I'm the Inclusion Healthcare Coordinator for the North Lewisham Primary Care Network. I work for a homeless charity called Groundswell, and I'm contracted into the NHS. As Inclusion Healthcare Coordinator, my main priority is to ensure that the healthcare needs are met for our most vulnerable patients. I do this by working with all NHS departments and outside agencies. I work with my patients to navigate the healthcare system and to also advocate on their behalf. A big part of my role is to also facilitate and manage the Rough Sleepers Clinic for Lewisham, which is a GP surgery once a week, a very busy transient clinic.
Amazing. Thank you. And last but not least, Jan, it'll be great to hear a bit about you and your work.
Thank you. Right, I'm Jan, as you just said. I also work for Groundswell, which is a charity that helps homeless people to get access to health services, either physical or mental health. And they also do a lot of research on the problems with healthcare and homelessness, access to healthcare, and where the barriers lie. I am also working for an NHS department. It's called SLAM, which is the South London and Maudsley, and then the work for the START Vulnerable Adults team, which is a specialised triage assessment and referral team. We work with people with dual diagnosis, so they have mental health issues and substance abuse. So we're dealing with people who have, let's say, had an interesting life. And there's loads of trauma, loads of anger, loads of resistance. And it's basically my job within the team to get people to engage with mental health services. I do that in two ways. I talk to the clients, try to build up a rapport with them. But I also talk to service providers to prepare them for these homeless clients.
It's great to hear about all of your work. So this series of the Going Beyond podcast is all about understanding the complex health and care needs of people experiencing homelessness and how best to support these individuals. So for this episode, I thought it would be useful to talk about how to support people to address their physical health needs. So I guess my first question to all of you is, what do you think are the barriers for people experiencing homelessness to accessing support with their physical health?
Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest barriers really is that, you know, the whole, you know, digital world is in. So, you know, with majority of GP surgeries now is that if you want to see a doctor, you first have to do an e-consult and you have to take pictures and you have to do all of that. Or, you know, you need to book an appointment online. And, you know, so that you need a smartphone, where a lot of homeless patients, for me, don't have smartphones. Mm-hmm. So it's the barrier starts right at the beginning to even try and get through that door, to try and get that appointment, where, you know, it's just all online, where, you know, in my role, you know, I've broken down all those barriers because of the work I do. But if it wasn't for a position like myself working with the Homeless Day Centre, it's like, how would these patients or, you know, clients actually get an appointment? It would be virtually impossible because you can't just walk into GP surgery anymore and say, can I have an appointment? It doesn't work like that anymore, does it?
In my experience, I've had clients who the GP service that says you need to call at 8 a.m. Some of my clients, A, don't have a phone, don't have data, don't have a clock. How are they meant to know what time to call? How are they meant to call? Yeah, so it's a massive, massive barrier. Or even those phone appointments can be really stressful for people because they prefer that face-to-face contact. They prefer actually connecting with someone, being able to ask questions, not be limited to a certain time frame. Yeah, so digital exclusion is a massive, massive barrier.
You're number one in the queue for 20 minutes. That's what happens. You get, okay, from now on, we are going to send appointments online. If you prefer us not to send them online, you need to type in this code and then we'll send you a letter. You say you want them to send a letter. They will send you one letter, after which the computer switches it back to online. So every time that you want a letter, you need to react. You need to punch in a code. And a lot of people just don't know what to do. They don't even know what it's about. I mean, why am I typing in a code? What letter are you going to send me? I mean, it's difficult. So with my clients, my appointment, their appointments now come to me. They come to my phone and then I inform them. So you get people voicemails. They can't handle voicemails. You've got people who've got hearing problems with the phones, the cheap phones that they have, with a telephone consultation. I mean, it's they simply cannot follow what being, and I'm not even talking about the language barrier. And I don't mean language barrier in the sense of natural language, but I'm talking about NHS language. Even I don't understand most of it. I have had letters that I had to have translated by professionals, and even they were saying, sorry, I haven't got a clue what it says. I haven't got a clue what it means. That's difficult. I think another barrier that I've come across quite a lot, especially when people are being treated in order to maintain their health, so they're on maintenance doses or maintenance trajectory, they refuse to take medication because they say it's not helping me, because they think it's not curing them. It's not making their problems go away. So it's then very difficult to convince them that they're taking the medication, they're going to have to jump through all the hoops just to keep them stable. So and that's part of the job. And it's just a question I've noticed. I do it my theory is little victories. So you talk to people, you don't give long lectures. You talk to people in short bursts. I also talk to all the people that I work with in the hostels, in GP surgeries, in the hospitals, to prepare in advance and to make sure that everybody is on the same frequency. So you don't get a situation that clients hear different stories from different people. What we do in the team, we try to get everybody involved so everybody knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. And even then it's difficult enough.
I think one of the new biggest barriers that have come up, I've noticed recently, is because of all the junior doctor strikes. So a lot of the striking that has happened is a lot of appointments, you've had appointments booked, they're then cancelled and then they get rebooked, and then they're cancelled and rebooked. So if the patient gets their post, because those appointments get sent out by post generally, it gets very confusing because they're getting an appointment, then a cancellation, then an appointment, and it's just, you know, it's kind of quite chaotic at the moment.
Yeah, I think also mentally that's a massive strain to put on someone, because I think, in my experience supporting clients to appointments, it's something that could be like maybe cancer related. Mm-hmm. And it's something that's, you know, really stressful, causes them a lot of anxiety. And it takes a lot of like groundwork and prep to get them ready for that appointment. And when it's canceled and moved 3-4 times, then it just becomes this thing that's just too heavy. And clients are just like, well, you know what, forget it. They're not going to see me anyways.
You know, with the homeless population and the way we manage, you know, GP services or primary care, you know, there's lessons to be learned. You know, the Westminster Borough does it really well because they have specialised homeless GP clinics, and they work incredible. You know, before I moved to Lewisham, I used to work out there, and it's, you know, so the change can be made in other boroughs and other parts of the country, you know, where there's big populations of homeless patients. There should be a specialised service, like you have a specialised service for cancer or for whatever else. That's the way, you know, it should be commissioned and worked, because it does work. Because like you said earlier, Taylor, a patient can't call at 8 o'clock in the morning. Those kind of things don't work. Where I'm really fortunate with the patients I support, they just come and see me. They just walk in and they call me on my mobile, and I sort something out for them. Do you know what I mean? If they're ill and they need to see a doctor, we run a clinic on a Wednesday, they're there. Some come, some don't. We run down the streets looking for them. It works. So, you know, you can change, you know, the way we work with the cohorts of homeless patients.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely agree with what you're saying about specialist services and the impact of having homeless specific, you know, GPs or doctors or practices. That's been a massive support in working with my clients. But I think sometimes what I face in maybe hospitals or with consultants who maybe don't have experience working with homelessness is that it's not very trauma-informed. That the way that they're delivering information sometimes will speak to me rather than speaking to the client. And exactly, it's their health, it's not mine. I'm just there as, like, you know, support them. So I think sometimes that's something that's not accounted for. And I mean, a lot of our clients do use substances and they do have mental health. Yeah. And we go into these appointments and these, you know, hospitals, whatever, and practitioners or even reception staff don't understand that. And so the way that they're meeting our clients is not respectful, and it's not in a way that clients are going to want to attend appointments.
It's quite common. I get that as well, that when you're sitting with the client and then the consultant is talking to you. What do you do when that happens?
Oh, well, what questions do you have asking me? And I'm like, well, ask them. They're right here. What do they have? Like, what do they want to know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I do. I just say, no, hold on, I'm not the patient. It's an angst on the inside to talk to a patient who they think doesn't understand anything. And it's also when it's said that people are undeserving. They are consumers like all of us. They go to the shops, they pay taxes, and they are totally entitled to the service that is available. So there is no excuse. And if they're ill, they're ill. So it's and usually, I mean, when they're ill and if they go to A&E or something like that, they have good reason. Yeah, I hardly see them going to hospital because they think hospital is such a nice place to be.
I once had a client was supporting him to hospital for a few tests and had gone outside for a cigarette. And I said, okay, that's fine. Come back when you're done. I'll sit and wait for your name to be called to let them know that you're still here, that you're not missing the appointment. Had gone out and security goes, you're homeless, you're not meant to be here. And he goes, no, I'm at an appointment, my health navigator's inside. He's like, no, you don't. You're just here because it's warm here. And he goes, no, I have an appointment. And he goes, no, like, if you let me, I'll go get her, I'll tell you I have an appointment. Eventually, I was like, he's not back. Go outside. He was really upset and was like, that security officer won't let me in just because he appeared homeless.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of kind of training that needs to happen for kind of people that work in the NHS, potentially, like you said, Taylor, like the interactions aren't necessarily trauma informed. There's a lot of assumptions that go on. Yeah. So there's loads of work that kind of needs to be done in that area. So I think we've touched a lot on the barriers, and this kind of links into why people experiencing homelessness are less likely to engage with physical health. So I think it would be interesting to think about other reasons why someone might not want to address their physical health needs. Maybe it is that that's not their priority in their life at that moment. There's other things going on, but it'll be interesting to hear what you think. Why is it that people might not want to think of, you know, address their health?
I think what I see with some of my patients I work with and see in the community where I work is mental health, because they've got such bad problems with their mental health that they're trying to focus on their mental health, which they're not getting support for, which is then they're neglecting their physical health. And I think you see that a lot. And I know this is not a mental health conversation, but that forms part of it, is because they're not mentally well, so they've got capacity but don't have capacity, if you see what I mean. And then they never meet the threshold to get proper help. So I think that, for me, that is quite big. I see that a lot.
Yeah, it's what I come across a lot, is that there's a lot of anxiety about what it might be. I had a client who had a black toenail. There had been issues in his family whereby there was a situation with gangrene and a leg that had to be amputated. So he said, I know about this, it's black toe, it's gangrene. Okay, let's go to the podiatrist and see what they've got to say. Yeah, of course. It took me 6 months to convince him eventually to go to see the podiatrist. Part of that was because of COVID. Podiatry were not coming to the hospitals and they weren't seeing anybody, so that's part of the 6 months. And eventually he went, and the podiatrist just scraped the fungus off his toe, told him about the other issues he had with his foot, that was all okay and could be healed and it was not a big problem. And he'd gotten himself into such a state. There is this negative thinking that they have about themselves. I find that difficult to negotiate, and I find that doctors find that difficult to negotiate, because I've been in multiple situations with clients that they try to force the conversation in order to sort of urge and coax the specialist to give them the answer that they want to hear. And I've frequently noticed with some doctors that they're not even aware that that's happening. And they're trying to come across to the client. So they're trying to communicate with the client. They try to bridge the conversation. And they find themselves saying something that they shouldn't be saying. Because basically they're saying that, no, there's nothing wrong with you, but there is something wrong with the client. That's only not as bad as the client thought it was. You know, so I find that quite surprising. I find it also difficult to deal with.
Yeah. But isn't really the biggest one, really, is if somebody's homeless, street homeless, you know, for them to start working on their health and working on their physical health, they need to be housed. Yep. You know, you need to be housed quite often. You know, trying to support somebody who's rough sleeping to get to all these appointments, to get, you know, life is chaotic when you're out there, let's face it.
And transport's expensive, getting to appointments.
Yeah.
In general, with Groundswell, we can provide transport, so it's rarely a problem. I've never found that was a barrier. I've never had a problem with that.
Were you referring to a cost of transport? Because I see that quite a lot. Is if you know, not every borough has the luxury of funding for taxi services. Mm-hmm. So I don't have much of that luxury. I can do some of it, but it's you know, getting that Oyster card topped up, or the bus tickets, and it's, you know, it is costly for a homeless person to get around to make appointments, right?
Yeah. And also in other experiences, clients don't feel like they're being taken seriously. They'll go to their GP, for example, saying something, and they'll be like, well, we can't see any physical symptoms. You're using substances. It could be linked to that. It could be linked to your mental health. So clients are left feeling like, okay, if I'm going to the one person who's meant to take my health seriously and they're not listening, like, why would I? Yeah. Why would I go for a test that they've now referred me to? Yeah. or yeah.
We're trying to intervene with that. It's not my idea, but it was an idea from the eye department at St. Thomas Hospital, and they asked for a patient passport. And so basically, you give a full itinerary of what the patient is like, and you tell them how they should interact with the patient. Like, don't use jargon. Give it, and either give the information straight, or you know, soften it down a bit, whatever is needed. So that can be quite a sheet with paper that people don't want to take with them. So we're now thinking of issuing people with these cheap phones that have a large screen. You can't use them as phones for the internet, but you can't put a file on. But you can put a file on that, and that would then be what you call them, an emergency alert. So if people find that on people, that's because I've got people who pass out. They collapse. They either because they're using drugs or because they fall over. So then they can find the phone. And because I've heard from services, I've talked to ambulance personnel and I've talked to the hospital staff, they're not allowed to plug USB sticks into their systems. So they need something where they can read it out straight away. So it's, no, they're not allowed to because of the risk of viruses. So
yeah, I mean, that's something we've also introduced is health passport. So it has, you know, medical conditions, allergies, upcoming appointments, services involved, which has been helpful. So we print them and hand them out to ambulance services.
I think that's a brilliant idea. Yeah. I wanted to move on now just to think about how can frontline workers best support people to improve their physical health? So, for example, how is it best to approach these conversations about health? Rather than just saying, tell me everything about your history of physical health, like how do we actually kind of bring up that conversation so that they can, you know, maybe engage in support in the future?
Building relationships.
Definitely.
You know, you need to, if you have a rapport and you build a relationship with the patient, quite often, you know, when I'm at the day centre that I support, you know, by sitting in the day centre and speaking to some of the, especially some of those that are reluctant to have the GP appointment or to see the doctor, we, you know, by sitting there having a conversation, and over a couple of weeks sometimes, it might take a couple of weeks, but eventually, you know, you might get them to you'll start getting them to engage. So it's by building a conversation. And, you know, when, if a, you know, GP appointments are 10 minutes, right? So if a patient goes and it's just 10 minutes, remember that 10 minutes, they have more than one physical health need. It's never just a sore wrist, for example. There's always other things going on as well. So we do 20 minutes homeless GP appointments. They're always overrun, but it's building a rapport, building a relationship. People buy from people. And do you know what?
Yeah, I think it's also important to take it at the individual's own pace. I think sometimes we're really rushed to meet this agenda or, you know, have this health need sorted. But I think, like you said, it's really important to take that time and build a relationship with someone and understand that it can take 6 months, like you said earlier. Yeah. Like, it can take time, but you need to let the individual steer that and then support them and be non-judgmental.
Now, I find that, like I said before, I mean, having chats with the medical staff in advance and explaining about the clients, that is important. And like building up rapport. I mean, let's face it, how would you find it if I come walking in the room and I start talking about body odor and I start talking about your feet and I start talking about... I'd probably go out through the window and land in the street. I mean, it's obnoxious to do something like that. You need to be in a position where you can actually have that kind of conversation with a client. I mean, they are people, and you have to treat them as such. And even with friends, I mean, you'd be very, very, very careful how you would approach issues like that, especially with mental health. And so that's what you do. You build up the rapport and you have to be in a position, unless, of course, it's an acute situation. That's different. I mean, then you have to take action. You're legally obliged to do so. You cannot allow a patient. I mean, the number one directive is always be safe. And that doesn't just apply to you as a service provider. That also applies to your patients. It applies to your colleagues. It applies to the general public. the situation has to be safe, and especially with a client. And we have clients who are so fearful or have such bad experiences or have so given up on themselves that they can be in very acute situations and are refusing to be taken by an ambulance or whatever. If push comes to shove, they have to be sectioned. And because it's your responsibility not to let them come to harm. You can't let people self-harm or come to harm. I mean, then you have to act. You cannot walk away. So it's, and of course we never do, but it's, I've rarely been in a situation that was necessary. Yeah, but it happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think as a frontline worker, there's no shame in just asking that individual how they want to be supported, mm-hmm. whether it's like phone calls, an email, you know, a face-to-face appointment, a virtual appointment. I think there's absolutely no harm in asking, because how else are you meant to work effectively with someone?
In my opinion, it's always the initiative lies with us, because the clients don't come to us, we go to the clients. So it's, but once that contact has been established, it's what the client wants you to do. I've never said to a client, right, okay, now let's get you, we'll plan a day in hospital and we'll turn you inside out and see what's wrong with you. And then we'll see how we're going to come with a treatment program for the next year. I don't think it will work anyway. So it's always, what are the problems that the clients face? And that's how you try to help, when they want help, how they want help. That's what you try to accommodate. But it has to be possible. We have to manage expectations as well. Mm-hmm. I get people, you know, they expect an appointment next week. Not going to happen. If you do take them to an appointment, already after 15 minutes, they go, I've had enough now. Can we go home now? And nothing has happened yet. So you need to manage expectations, and sometimes you have to be firm.
Yeah, just sort of being very clear and transparent about what service they can expect, basically, and what's the time frame surrounding that. So before we finish up, I just wanted to kind of maybe talk about the real need for partnership work in this kind of area of physical health. And I think we touched on it a little bit before, but kind of that need for multidisciplinary meetings, and how can we kind of make sure that frontline workers are kind of able to connect with everyone. I don't know if you've got any experiences of kind of being able to bring all professionals together, because obviously that is a way that we can really understand what's going on in that person's life, and that, you know, their doctor is now linked up with their drug and alcohol worker, and then those conversations can happen. But I think it's really important.
Yes, so that's, go ahead. I was gonna say, that's something we do at SHP, is we hold different MDTs, so multidisciplinary team meetings, however, all these acronyms. So we hold those meetings, often including like a GP, any specialist. In the past, we've had like an epilepsy nurse, we've had a consultant from hospital, we've had their drug and alcohol worker, hostel support worker, myself, and any other services involved. And I found that it's been really effective to make sure that we're all on the same page, and that, for example, with the consultant and the GP, they were able to say, okay, this is the plan, I'm glad you're doing this, we're on the right page. And then we're also able to like voice the client's concerns and just really provide like a comprehensive plan moving forward. It's been really good.
Absolutely. We do a lot of them. So, you know, so we do patient individual MDTs. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, we also look at a rough sleep and MDT. So then, you know, there's a big meeting where, you know, we'll discuss a caseload of rough sleepers. But it's really important. And there's, you know, there's other MDTs I'm involved in as well, for within like Lewisham and the South East, is where we have the London Ambulance Service, we have the consultant from A&E, and it's a really big meeting with a lot of people, but it covers a big spectrum of all agencies for those really, really, you know, those high intensity cases and patients, I guess, where there's, you know, a lot of trauma, there's a lot of everything going on in their lives with those rough sleepers, with that cohort. We did a lot of those meetings.
Yeah, the MDTs are really important, because first of all, you're compiling a lot of knowledge, And so you're more likely to come, if in a crisis situation, you're more likely to come to a conclusion, to a solution. Because we always say two know more than one. So it's the difficulty I find with MDTs is if there's a crisis situation and then you have to pull the people together. We are trying to organize an MDT about a client right now. And I think we've got a date fixed now. And that took about a week of emails going back and forth. But that's the only exception. I mean, that can be difficult. But MDTs are vital. It's like I said before, it is vital that you pull everybody in so that everybody knows what you're talking about and what's going on with regard to the client.
Yeah.
That's vitally important.
I also think having like a specialist role, so we're all in pretty similar roles, has been effective in my work, being a key point of contact within the charity or within a service. So being able to hold those partnerships has been really effective to go to services and say, what's your offer? How can we work together? What can we do as a charity to support you? And coming together to form, like I said, we do in-reach offers with a variety of services. So yeah, it's just having those discussions.
And I think sometimes for me as well, you know, is when I'm advocating on behalf of those patients in an MDT, is holding services to account. Do you know what I mean? Because sometimes you have to ask some of these services the hard questions, because you know it's you acting on, you know, in the best interest of the patient. And I do feel there are services where, you know, patients do get let down. It happens a lot. So you have to be asking those hard questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. But thank you, Taylor, Jan and Oscar, for coming to speak with me today. It's been so useful to think about the barriers people experiencing homelessness face in accessing support with their physical health and how, as frontline workers, we can approach these conversations about health. But yes, thank you all for your time.
Thanks for listening. To keep up to date with the latest goings on at HomelessLink, please follow us on Twitter @HomelessLink. If you're interested in training and development opportunities for yourself, your team, or your organisation, get in touch by emailing training@homelesslink.org.uk. We have a range of courses that help staff and organisations develop the skills needed to tackle current issues and improve services.